Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Backlash continues against this year's Nobel winner for literature. Peter Handke, the Austrian playwright and novelist, is accused of being an apologist for violent nationalism. I speak to his biographer, Malte Herwig, and to Europe historian Peter Frankopan about why this argument matters, especially today. And
an artist's job is to bite the hand that feeds him, but not too hard.
Contemporary artist Grayson Perry on his journey from provocateur to national treasure. Then,
watching from my window, the curtain coming down.
Our Walter Isaacson talks to Rhiannon Giddens, the Grammy Award-winning roots musician who turns her banjo into a time machine.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The eternal Brexit roller coaster returns to Parliament this weekend. Boris Johnson will see whether he has the votes to pass the deal that he has just reached with the EU at a special session on Saturday. The main stumbling block, as always, is the thorny issue of the Irish border and fear that the fragile peace between Ireland and the United Kingdom could be shattered by the reimposition of border controls there. That is literally a deal breaker for the EU, whose mission is to uphold peace on this historically bloody continent. If the European experiment feels particularly fragile now, that feeling can be traced back to the Balkans in the 1990s, where Europe saw the first outbreak of violent nationalism since World War II, which is why critics were so alarmed when this year's Nobel Prize in Literature was given to Austrian novelist and playwright Peter Handke. Handke is accused of being an apologist for the Serbian project of Slobodan Milosevic, whose henchmen in Bosnia conducted a campaign of ethnic cleansing and genocide. To grapple with the Nobel Committee's controversial selection at this fragile time in Europe, I spoke to Handke's biographer, Malte Herwig, and to Peter Frankopan, professor of global history at Oxford University. Peter Frankopan, Malte Herwig, welcome to the program. So because we're talking about this Nobel Prize being awarded to a guy who's been accused of being an apologist for violent nationalism and genocidal program of Slobodan Milosevic, who was known as the Butcher of the Balkans, just remind our viewers, I guess, the significance of the Balkan Wars happening in Europe when they did.
Well, in 1989, this time 30 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down. And at that point, nobody could predict what would happen next. There was an assumption amongst many military strategists that the Soviet Union would send in the tanks or that states would put down their own populations heavily. And the only place that really happened was in Yugoslavia, where the leadership in Belgrade decided to try to keep the country together. That led to a war from more or less from 1991 until the Dayton peace agreements in 95. And that was a period of profound suffering. And again, you saw it with your own eyes of the kind of the murders that happened on a, in some cases, a mechanized basis in Srebrenica and Gorazde, but also the suffering in places like Sarajevo. That saw the way in which human beings, under the wrong circumstances in the wrong times, are capable of inflicting profound violence on each other. And Milosevic was the leader of that process of trying to use force to achieve his own ends. And that process that took up most of the 90s saw bloodshed in the tens of thousands, not just on the doorstep of Europe, but in Europe itself. And so it is quite salutary to be reminded of the fact that no one has a monopoly on being peaceful, and that the wrong decisions can escalate very, very quickly.
And Malte, I mean, I know that you're the biographer, amongst other books, you're the biographer of Peter Handke, who's won the Nobel Prize in Literature. And he, as I said, has been accused of being an apologist for precisely this kind of violent nationalism that we're talking about, that I covered and my colleagues did throughout the 90s. And it was the first such eruption of this in Europe since the end of World War II. What are your thoughts on him winning the Nobel Prize, firstly?
Well, I think it says a lot about the quality of public debate in our time when people make this out to be a stark partisan choice. You know, you're either against him or you're for him. People either want to hero worship or totally vilify him. What's interesting is that the loudest champions of truth and facts don't seem to have a problem with ignoring or bending the facts themselves in order to cast Handke as an amoral monster and apologist for genocide, which he isn't. Now, as his biographer, I can tell you Peter Handke has lots of flaws and has made many mistakes, and I write about them liberally in the biography. But I think we should take him to task on those and not on what he's supposed to have said already.
He's basically said, and as you know, he spoke at the funeral of Slobodan Milosevic, and a lot of people just can't believe that a guy who did that, you know, was awarded the Nobel Prize, calling him rather a tragic man. He accused, and I remember this because it was going around at the time, he accused Bosnians in Sarajevo of staging massacres during the war. That was a trope that was put forward by Milosevic and his henchmen in Bosnia. And he also alleged that Serbs unfairly received too much of the blame. And as you know, and as we all know in retrospect, that blame was justified because it was backed by ironclad evidence at the war crimes tribunals in The Hague. Milosevic obviously died before he was convicted, but he was accused of heinous crimes, and many of his henchmen were convicted of genocide or crimes against humanity.
The points you are making are absolutely correct. And he said those things during what we might call the fog of war, and he was wrong. I think Peter Handke is guilty of allowing himself to be instrumentalized by Serb nationalists. So when Handke spoke at Milosevic's funeral, many people say he eulogized Milosevic, he worshipped him or something like that. Now, it wasn't anything like that. He said he was going to use weak words today and to be there as a witness.
So Handke and the awarding of this Nobel, there's very few people who've praised him for it, and the most prominent, in fact, are in Serbia.
What is the meaning of it then to you, sir?
Yeah, it's a kind of, I feel a strange kind of freedom, I don't know. Of freedom, and as if I were, which is not the truth, as if I were innocent.
What do you think he's saying there? It's a little weird. As if I were innocent, which is not the truth.
Handke, I think, was born guilty in his view. So, in a way, us condemning him almost can't touch him.
He was born guilty?
He was born guilty, in a way.
What does that mean?
You can see that a feeling of guilt, a sort of existential guilt, almost from, you know, his teenage years on. And Handke is the poet of self-doubt and self-exploration. He constantly questions himself. In fact, if you look at the text of his speech, his very short speech at Milosevic's funeral, he questions himself there. He says, I don't know the truth. And he constantly says that.
Is that a good enough explanation for you, Peter Frankopan?
Well, I think that the idea that truth is elastic is in itself quite interesting in these so-called post-truth times. And I think we do have to be very careful. You know, we believe in the West in the sanctity of free speech. And I think we have to detach the fact that that means that sometimes people are going to have views that we don't like. To pick this particular moment seems to me either intentionally provocative. It doesn't mean that Handke doesn't deserve for his writings. But at the same time, I'm very surprised that having suggested this was a time to look more broadly at the world, that we pick somebody who's rooted in Europe of the last 30, 40, 50 years, the collapse of Yugoslavia, the views about Milosevic, who didn't just murder people outside Serbia. You know, he established a police state that turned into a kleptocracy and, you know, still undergoing fundamental reforms. This does send a particular message where when a writer and a scholar like he appears on Serbian state media saying, I'm innocent, he's also saying all Serbs are innocent. And Historians were very careful about how those lessons are taught, particularly in Germany, where I've been just today. So there, how we understand, how we confront the past, means facing up to these truths and not allowing people to say that I don't know what truth is.
I just wanted to read to you what Jennifer Egan, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning, multi-award-winning American novelist and currently the head of PEN in the United States. We reject the decision that a writer who has persistently called into question thoroughly documented war crimes deserves to be celebrated for his linguistic ingenuity, which was in the citation. At a moment of rising nationalism, autocratic leadership, and widespread disinformation around the world, the literary community deserves better than this. We deeply regret the Nobel Committee on Literature's choice. And, you know, Salman Rushdie has once called him, you know, International Moron of the Year, and he called him, you know, called him out for, quote, a series of impassioned apologies for the genocidal regime of Slobodan Milosevic. So, again, I know that you're sort of qualifying Peter Handke's work and what he said and what he didn't say and what, whether he was there. But do you think that it was right to award him this prize at this time or at any time, frankly?
I think it is actually right precisely because he is challenging and problematic, because that's something we lose sight of all too easily nowadays. I think nowadays we hand out prizes mainly in order to celebrate ourselves and to confirm ourselves in our moral superiority. And I think that's wrong because it's intellectually lazy and dishonest. I think it's much more insightful to engage with someone who actually challenges us, sometimes in unpleasant ways. Art, perhaps the last bastion of free thinking, because let's look at the Nobel Prize record for the Nobel Prize in Literature. So in the years before the First World War, the Nobel Committee took this idealist direction very seriously. Did they give a prize to Émile Zola, you know, famous writer? No, he was much too dispirited and grossly cynical. Did they give a prize to Tolstoy? No, because Tolstoy believed that chance events could change world history and War and Peace and so on, you know. If you were an atheist, no, you would qualify for the prize. You had to basically conform to a very romantic, conservative, reactionary idea of harmony. So instead, who got the prize? Sully, Prudhomme, Bjørnstjerne Bjørnson. Third-raters who no one knows anything.
Handke, he called for the abolition of the Nobel Prize, right? And so he could have turned it down if it really meant nothing to him. There's no obligation to accept this great honour. And I think that making an award like this right now would seem to me to reheat some of those passions that are still very alive in the Balkans, as you know. The traumas of the war have not been fully dealt with. The war crimes tribunals, not either in some cases, been completed. And these are still live issues that require a very careful touch on working out how to build and breathe peace back into the Balkans, to celebrate someone who has said these things, who has stood by Milosevic's grave and said, I don't know what the truth is, and to then say he's innocent. That shows our moral corruption. That shows how low we've come in Europe, that these things don't have meaning. Anyone can say whatever they like, and there's no consequences for that, because these are just words, and who knows what truth even means. So that reduction down where we clash between freedoms of speech and allowing people to have views that we don't like and, in some cases, distasteful. But on the other hand, how do we prioritise those over trying to build safe communities?
Well, let me ask you then, because actually, this is a big one. I mean, the violation of international norms and the gross violation of international humanitarian law was codified in international law after the Second World War. That's why we have this notion of crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing. So I guess my question is, is there a crime and a sympathy with a crime or an acknowledgement that perhaps the perpetrator of that crime had a point? Is that one step too far? I mean, should there be a red line for something in the field as serious as genocide, not just something you disagree with what a writer might have said in his political life, but something on this level?
This is a crucial point, because Handke never condoned or justified or sympathized with the crime committed by Serbs. What he did, he pointed out that Serbs were also victims. Now, he's surely guilty of the sin of comparison.
The sin of relativism, because they weren't also victims, as much as the Bosnians and the others.
No, but that's exactly the point. I mean, the international tribunal did not just convict Serbs.
Correct.
But of course, the Serbs were the main perpetrators.
Correct.
Milosevic
Correct.
Was responsible
Absolutely.
Mainly for
and the
war. Karadzic and Mladic.
Isn't that the point? 8,000 Muslim boys and men were slaughtered in Srebrenica. This is what the spokesman for the mothers of Srebrenica said.
Awards used to be given to those who were standing for peace, for things that were of benefit to mankind and the world. This award, however, has shocked us, and it is hurting us, and it has brought us back to 1995. I don't know what kind of message this sends to our grandchildren. I simply don't have an answer to this.
So again, we're talking about the most heinous crimes
Yes.
under international law, and the crimes that we're meant to remember and not repeat because of what happened in our modern history, and that's Nazism, and because of what then led to Europe as a project for peace, amongst others.
I have to clarify this point, because when we talk about the Srebrenica massacre, Handke called the massacre in Srebrenica the worst crime against humanity in Europe since 1945.
But he also said the Bosnians in Sarajevo staged their own massacre, in other words, killed themselves.
Sure, but this was about Srebrenica.
Correct.
And I want to just clarify this particular point, because that's how we need to start. And we can, you know, criticize him for what he got wrong. He also got the killings in Visegrad wrong, by the way. Absolutely. So take him to task for that, but not as a apologist of genocide and mass massacres like in Srebrenica.
But Martin, he was at the funeral of Milosevic. He didn't have to go to that. He chose and wanted to make a statement of
Sure.
solidarity or with the Serbs, with Milosevic. He could have done that in all sorts of different ways, but it's such an aggressive statement to say that he wants to be there when this man is buried, is put into the ground. And I don't know what the tribunal would have ruled with Milosevic. They never got that far. But I think anybody who spent time in the Balkans in the 90s had no illusions about what it was that Milosevic had done. And so
yeah.
to make that step and to say, I'm only doing it to be an observer, seems to me quite a fancy way of dancing around reality.
Call it naive. But something you said before, that Handke calls into question...
Would you tell the mother from Srebrenica that she's naive? I don't call it. I think one has to call it out.
No, I'm calling Handke naive.
Well, you can call him naive and excuse it, but I think one has to make a decision. The only decision I think you can justify with Handke is to say, we live in a world of freedom of speech, and that entitles people to have views that are repugnant. And separately, the quality of a man or a woman's work is separate from their character as a human being. And those two are the only ways in which you can go on this, right? Rather than saying, well, it's all a bit complicated and it was naive because he's difficult. I think it's one or the other.
Would you agree with that? Would you concede that?
I don't think the world is black and white. I would say he was naive. He allowed himself to be instrumentalized by Serbs. He certainly completely overshot the mark in his attempt to take on the language of war. To look in a direction where no one else was looking, for good reasons. You know, I give you that. So I'm not on his side.
I think other people were looking in those areas. I mean, we even had Harold Pinter, who was roundly criticised for his seeming sympathy towards Slobodan Milosevic. Let me read something from another highly awarded writer, Hari Kunzru, who he has taught Peter Handke's work to his students. He's currently a professor at Columbia in New York. More than ever, we need public intellectuals who are able to make a robust defense of human rights in the face of the indifference and cynicism of our political leaders. Handke is not such a person. Again, he teaches Handke, and he's obviously objects to this award. But let's bring it back to the historic moment that we face right now, which is our dangerously post-truth world, our dangerously nationalistic and populist world, and the fact that however we read it, Northern Ireland is the main sticking point with Brexit because people don't want to see yet another European peace project disrupted.
So it's not just about Northern Ireland. So all across Europe right now, this week we've had major problems in Catalonia where, apart from police being on the street, we have leaders of the Catalan movement on trial for sedition. We see support for the European Union collapsing across many countries, not just in the UK. You know, the surveys in the summer had 58% of French not believing that the EU will last for another 10 years. And in fact, in Germany, Pew Research Center report says that 40% of Germans don't believe that the democratic system is the ideal way to run a country. And so we've got all sorts of challenges here in Europe. It's not just about nationalism, it's about profound dissatisfaction. And when you have dissatisfaction, particularly we don't understand where it comes from, it's inequality, economic, social, all the freedoms of movement that are up for grabs right now, then it gives a perfect platform for ideologues with snappy slogans to come who explain things in a simplistic way. And that's why we find the rise of the hard left and also of the hard right in almost every single country in Europe right now. There's no centrist leader almost anywhere in Europe, let alone the US, who's able to keep the show on the road. And the demand is for this pressure from the left and the right. And again, as we saw in Yugoslavia, when those things ignite and people are being overwhelmed into knee-jerk reactions, then there can be real traumas and tragedies that result.
It's really a fascinating discussion. Thank you both very much indeed. Peter Frankopan and Malte Hörvig, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And even the harshest critics of Peter Handke's politics acknowledge that he is a brilliant writer. Which brings me to another artist who's faced his own fair share of critical barbs, Grayson Perry. He's a London-based contemporary sculptor, carpet weaver, printmaker and ceramicist. And his work challenges the fashions and the foibles of the world's collector class. His public experiments in gender identity challenge our own innate prejudices. Perry has a new exhibit on view called, with characteristic self-deprecation, Super Rich Interior Decoration. When I spoke with him at the gallery here in London, I asked him about his journey from the fringes of the art world to Mayfair, the stomping ground of the British upper class. Grayson Perry, welcome back to our programme.
Thank you.
I just want to point out to you that you are now being referred to as a national treasure. How does that feel after being the outsider for all your career?
I think I've missed something out in the middle. I'll take it, you know, because it does reflect my sort of philosophy to art in a way, in that I think the outsider stance, you can wear it out a bit much, you know, especially when you start having a successful career. And I'm a member of the Royal Academy, you know, and I've got a gong from the Queen, you know, all these sort of things. I can't pretend that I'm an outsider anymore.
What's your gong again?
I got a CBE.
Excellent. Well, listen, you say the Royal Academy, and in a way, an experience there, I believe, led to this exhibition, or at least the naming of this exhibition, because you recount that you were there for a particular event, and one of your members said, this is very decorative.
Yeah, he called it, like, he said, I see what you've done, interior decoration. And I thought, yeah, I said, that's what we all do, us artists, super rich interior decoration.
Well, it's really interesting because that idea of interior design is sort of meant as a put-down, right? Yeah. But you decided to throw it back into his face. And in fact, you have named this super rich interior decoration.
Yeah, I mean, this is my first commercial show in quite a long time. And I like this gallery that Victoria Miro has in Mayfair because it's small and I make small work. And so I thought I would make a work that sort of played on the fact that I'm in the richest part of London. They're going to be sold to private individuals, you know. And so I wanted to kind of acknowledge and also play with that, you know. I wanted to point out the hypocrisies and perhaps unacceptable behaviour of the super rich, but also say, you're part of the conversation. You know, we depend on you, the art world. The money, not just in for private individuals like myself, but institutions depend on the, you know, munificence, that's right, of the super rich.
They also have, in some cases, some major issues like OxyContin by the Sackler family. And yet, some museums have pulled that sponsorship, but others are beginning to say, hang on a second, we actually need the money. Why don't we just make them pay for their sins, quote unquote? What is your view on that?
I think it's a very complex issue because, you know, galleries, they're being starved of money by the public purse because of austerity, you know, and that's not exactly high in their list of priorities. And so they're having to find funds from somewhere. And if you dig down in a lot of money, really, you know, Tate Gallery, clues in the title. We know what Tate was a sugar company. Where do you think they got the sugar from? Who do you think cut the sugar cane? You know, it's all there. And so there's some sort of delicate manoeuvring and diplomacy to be done. But then, you know, the galleries, they are for the public good too. You know, usually they're free in Britain. And most of the big museums that accept this kind of sponsorship, they're free. And so, you know, what's the alternative?
But I also find you yourself throughout your career, and certainly what I've been reading about some of your works, you also embody a lot of contradictions because you're not just a decorative artist, you're not just an artist, you operate in a political context. Mm. And let's just take one of the major, major pieces here, which is really quite moving. It's beautiful as well. The one with the homeless figure. Tell me the story of this carpet. How did you conceive it?
How it works, I think, really, is that it's a very seductive object. It's these lovely kind of ice creamy colours. It's very patterny. It has a kind of vaguely sort of traditional carpet vibe going on it. And yet you've got this homeless person. And of course, the idea, you know, the central idea is, and it hovers in the air, even if it never happens, is someone is going to walk on a homeless person, you know, and it's called Don't Look Down. So it's almost like an acknowledgement of that glass floor that the wealthy have put below them because they are scared of ending up like this, and they're scared of their children ending up like this, and so they ring-fence their privilege in various subtle and not so subtle ways.
But people give them a wide berth when you look at them on the pavement.
Yes, and I think that's interesting. In a carpet, you might give a wide berth to. I mean, for me, this is the best piece in the show because it has so many kind of subtext going on in it. And it's difficult, you know, and it works, you know, it exemplifies the nature of my work in that it's seductive and decorative, and you think, oh, I really covetable, I want that, and yet it also repulses, and I think, and makes you think, and I think that is what my entire career has been about in many ways.
And they don't mind it rubbed in their face, because that's what you're doing.
Because they know it's true. That it might be uncomfortable, and I'm sure all the people, you know, the very wealthy people that buy my art, I'm sure they would describe themselves on their CVs as philanthropists.
You know? Okay, I want to know who buys this, and then I want to know what this person does.
I'm fascinated.
Yeah, I want to know. So this, I think you're satirizing the idea of making Ming vases into table lamps.
Well, it's one of the great sacrileges of kind of interior design history was that, you know, in the past, interior designers would turn lovely old antique vases into table lamps, you know. And it was a terrible affront, if you like, to the purist like me who, you know, all of my inspiration comes from antique vases.
What are you saying about rich people and their money in here?
Well, I think there's often, you know, a kind of hypocrisy that goes on in people who, you know, describe themselves as philanthropists, and then they've got their parking most of their dosh in somewhere like Panama or somewhere.
Or Jersey.
In order to stop paying tax. And I think you wouldn't have to be a philanthropist if you paid all your tax in the first place, because the state would have more money, and then you wouldn't need these charities, you know. And so that's what I'm trying to say with this thing.
Vogue said that where this exhibition is a little bit where making fun of the wealthy overlaps with Made for the Wealthy. That's the nexus where your show exists. Do you agree?
Yes, totally. I mean, I'm, as to quote Boris Johnson, you know, I'm very pro-cake and pro-eating it. But, you know, that's often art operates in ambiguity. You know, it's a very important thing. You know, it's happy, sad, tragicomic. You know, it's, these things are often good. And I think that serious humorous and being kind of on the side of morality and also trying to throw light on immorality at the same time is something I'm fascinated by. These are inanimate objects, you know, they're not doing anything wrong. I love playing with that. And I think both sides enjoy it because, you know, the man on the street can come in here and look at them and go, yeah, we're going to stick it to the man. You know, look at Grayson, he's taking the piss out of the people who have tax havens. You know, whatever. And on the other hand, the person with the tax haven can come along and go, yep, that's me. I actually said, this tapestry, someone came up to me and said, I looked at your tapestry, Grayson, and I went through all those words you've written on it. He said, yeah, that's me to a T, you know, that you've got me.
Well, I think that's actually amazing, because isn't that called a very rich, what is that one called?
That's called large, expensive, abstract painting.
Exactly. Which is kind of what you're saying, a lot of art buyers and collectors don't really know what they're buying, but they just want a large, expensive, abstract painting.
Yeah, that's the kind of subtext there, you know, that those things, you know, the large and expensive might be more important than the abstract or the painting. Rich art collectors, you know, they're usually intelligent, well-educated people, and they're pretty robust, you know, they've quite often been in the boardroom and all politics or whatever, and the to and fro of life. They're not kind of snowflakes, you know, they kind of like, they take it on the chin. And, you know, Nam June Paik said right back in the 70s, an artist's job is to bite the hand that feeds him, but not too hard.
And you agree with, he's, of course, the American video artist?
Yes, very, very famous. Yeah. He was one of the absolute pioneers of video art.
You either were described or described yourself in your early days as being, you know, angry about aspects of life, angry about the political realities, angry about the social inequalities. Now I've seen that you've sort of described yourself as an amateur sociologist, anthropologist. You're sort of shifting your own mood a little bit on what you're seeing.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been through various phases in my career. I mean, I've got a show coming out next year that's touring the country. That's all my work before 92, 94. And it's called Grace and Perry, the pre-therapy years, you know. Because I think that was the real watershed in me. And I was angry and to a certain extent quite bitter about, you know. But it was. I don't think it's with the art world, it's just me. And I was holding emotionally in my body. And afterwards, you know, I've got a more kind of broader view of the world. And my work became less autobiographical and it's more about society now. And, you know, I think it's improved for that, you know.
And you were mostly angry about it. You had an unhappy childhood.
Yeah, you know, and I think that, you know, I was carrying a lot of unexamined feelings, yeah, which I did in the course of therapy, and I now feel pretty cleansed of those in the home.
So the therapy is the watershed moment.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, to be honest with you, and that's not about this subject necessarily, but that's probably a really important message for a lot of people, young people, older people right now struggling with mental health crises.
Yeah, I wouldn't say every sort of mental health crisis is you can deal with it by talking to a therapist, but I think a lot more than people imagine, because, you know, a lot of the most sort of basic ways we go through the world, you know, we inherit them and they're dysfunctional from our past, and we've got to unpick those.
Was Claire, your alter ego, part of trying to brighten up a difficult life, or did she have nothing to do with your childhood?
Oh, I'm sure she had a lot to do with my childhood. I mean, if you think about... I mean, I often joke that there's no one as sexist as a transvestite, mm-hmm. because a transvestite, someone like me, depends on very clear gendered behaviour in order to be excited about crossing the boundary, yeah. about being in the wrong clothes, about doing the wrong behaviours, you know. And there's an excitement and a stimulation and an erotic charge in those things. And so if we lived in a world where, you know, people of either sex could behave in any way they felt free, then there wouldn't be any transvestites.
And you actually said that you're feeling... As you say, things have moved so far that nothing is abnormal, so to speak, or nothing is crossing the line, and you're no longer feeling like you're the, you know, the weirdo in the street in a dress.
Well, I'm Grayson Perry now. I'm still the weirdo in the street in the dress, but I'm Grayson Perry the weirdo, which makes it very different because celebrity trumps kind of a front in some sort of way. So people, when they see me now, they might think, oh, it's Grayson Perry. And that's nice. You know? And I have one of the great things that I like, and because of my TV work, and the nature of the kind of subjects I deal with, I have a very broad demographic in my audience. So I love it when a cabbie shouts to me, "Love your tapestries, Grayson!" You know, as he's going past. And I always think, I'm working, it's working, you know, great.
Has Claire changed? To me, she's looking a bit more bouffanty, those diamante glasses, more sort of grand dame.
Yeah, I mean, it's a look that I've always loved, you know, ever since the 60s, I suppose, because I grew up... And our sexuality, to a certain extent, is shaped in our childhood, you know. That's when the building blocks of our sexuality are laid down, particularly the styling. And, you know, I grew up in a world of women with big hair who were very well-groomed, you know. And so I've always had a soft spot for the grand dame with the big beehive hairdo. And so, yeah, I like going out in that look now, you know, and I'm on a pot over there, you know, going around all the West End shops dressed as that grand dame. And I love that look. You know, it's probably my fave look, but it takes a lot of work and money.
I think you said an hour and a half of makeup.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, it's a labour of love. More a labour of lust, maybe, I'm not sure.
Okay, so Grayson, this is you as Claire. What are you saying? You're outside all these fancy clothes shops.
I mean, all these designer clothes shops are within a handbag's throw of this exact gallery. I mean, we're here in Mayfair in London. And so I thought it would be fun to do a piece that kind of acknowledged that, but also it's called Shopping for Meaning. It's an acknowledgement of the humanity of the rich in some ways, you know, and sort of saying, you're looking for meaning, you know.
I do notice you do have a soft spot for the rich. I mean, you are trying to I love them. buy me. But you are trying to also humanise them. I mean, we are living in a moment where the super rich are not the most super popular.
A lot of the problems that are attributed to the rich reach fairly far down the income scale. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, it's the average income, but, you know, someone who can afford a nice house in the middle of a big city in one of the developed countries is doing all right. Yeah. And I think that they might want to look into their own eye before they, you know.
And interestingly, in the other room, we saw where you're actually making fun of them with their money going on holiday and that whole sort of Instagram super rich world. And here, you're doing what you've just said, humanising them. So again, you have this constant flow of contradiction throughout almost every piece and between pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, I that's the line I want to dance, because I think that in the end, as an artist, a polemic is quite dull. You know, it has no frisson. When I see a comedy show, I like when I don't quite know whether to cry or laugh. You know, they're the sweet spots for me. And so I try to sort of, in my own way, with my work, try to find, you know, where people are kind of, ooh, you know, like, and like
that. Should I laugh? Should I cry?
Yeah, and,
should I buy it?
And
should
I think all these things are very, very important, because they're human and that's who we are. And I suppose it is, you know, I don't want to aggrandize my project, but in the end, I want people to acknowledge that we're complicated, you know, and human, and we've got to deal with that. We're not a kind of set of facts and statistics.
Finally, I just want to sort of get you to talk about your message here. Do you want to read this? You wrote it. It's the last paragraph in an article you wrote for the FT.
Oh, OK. There we go. In the perverse spirit of the times, I'm trying to critique and call out the hypocrisies and antisocial behaviour of the super rich while colluding with them and sucking up to them at the same time. What's not to like? And I think that, you know, that does sum it up. And I think that in this age of polarisation and divisions in society, I think we've all got to come to terms and have a bit of empathy for the other side, you know. And you might find some of their opinions, but nobody is really as black and white as Twitter would make you think, you know. And I've just been shooting a TV series in the States, you know, and about these issues. And the minute you talk to anybody, all that, you know that, Christiane. You know, the minute you talk to the person, you've got a flesh and blood person in front of you, and they're nuanced and complex, and it's difficult, you know, because you might like them, and yet they hold abhorrent views, and it's tricky.
Okay. Grace and Perry, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And we could certainly all do with more empathy in today's world. Now, since political and social currents run through art, we turn now to the award-winning musical polymath Rhiannon Giddens, a folk singer and multi-instrumentalist. Giddens grew up in North Carolina, and she's also a classically trained opera singer. She's on a mission to reframe the history of African Americans and their contributions to the musical landscape, a quest that's already won her a MacArthur Genius Grant. Rhiannon sat down with our Walter Isaacson to discuss her latest album, There Is No Other, and to play some banjo.
You have this amazing new album called There Is No Other, and it's about diversity and different strains coming together. Mm. First, let me ask you about your own personal ancestry.
My parents got married in North Carolina, interracial couple, got married, you know, three years after the loving decision. You
in
know?
Other words, that allowed interracial marriage in North Carolina.
Yeah. I grew up kind of going back and forth between my white side and my black side. And then kind of as the years would pass, you kind of hear these hints of, you know, stories about Indian blood and this and that, and kind of going, all right. And then I started kind of getting interested in that side of things, you know.
So Native American background,
yeah.
That you had too.
And so I got interested in in that side of things, at the high school that I went to, there was a Native American drumming group there called a Quago, and a powwow that happens there every year. And so I learned how to sing powwow songs and, you know, really just kind of explored that just for my own self.
And where is this?
This is in this was in Durham, North Carolina.
Durham, so at the North Carolina.
Norcon School of Science and Mathematics.
Because you have Greensboro, William, and Durham, quite a few of North Carolina roots in you. How does it all come together? And what are you trying to do by bringing it together with this album?
I kind of feel like I represent, you know, a lot of the South, which is a mixture of Black, white, and Native elements. You know, we're not quite sure exactly what comes from what. Sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. And that's kind of how my, you know, my roots are. And I don't like to, that's why I kind of, I'm not looking for any kind of validation or claiming a particular kind of this or that. It's kind of like, well, I'm a mix. And I think the best of American music comes from that aspect of it, the mixture. And so that's kind of what I've been doing with my music in America, like looking particularly at the African American part of things, because in the music that I've been interested in, it's been sort of suppressed, the true role of Black Americans in the creation of some of these things, like, you know, country music, old time music, bluegrass, you know, things that are at the heart of a lot of what is really American. And so I've been doing that for some years, and this record, you know, There Is No Other, it was an opportunity to place that in a global context.
And it talks about the ties that bind us as well.
Exactly. So, you know, when I met Francesco, who was, you know, my musical partner, who I did the record with, you know, he's from Italy. Very similar story to mine. I went to a classical school and learned how to sing opera, and then kind of came back to my roots in North Carolina. And, you know, he went to conservatory and then kind of went back to the folk, you know, music of his folks, which would be the Mediterranean, you know, and his family's all from Sicily. And, you know, his journey has been trying to, you know, talk about how mixed that area is, and how you wouldn't say have the Renaissance without the years of Arabic, you know, domination of Spain, of Sicily, of all these areas. You have this incredible influx of cultural elements from somewhere else that then transformed what was already there. And so that's what I've been talking about on my side of things. So we basically kind of just met across the Atlantic Ocean and found out that there's actually a lot of similarities and parallels in what we're both doing. And so that's kind of what we've done, is put our musics together.
So I saw you in the Ken Burns documentary on country music. Mm-hmm. And we think of country music as sort of a white genre. Mm-hmm. And you've helped resurrect the roots of country music from many diverse backgrounds, including the African American one.
Well, I mean, I'm you know, in a handful of people who've really been trying to change the narrative or restore the narrative, because really it has been a crafted thing. And as I've been researching, what I find is that it didn't happen by accident. This idea that the banjo is a white instrument, the country is this, you know, bastion of pure white culture, because that's what it's sold as. And so when I first got into folk music and found the origins of the banjo being African American, and I was like, what? You know, and then I kind of started going, well, what else don't I know? And that's really kind of what started me down the path, you know, which is why I'm sitting in front of you today. It's kind of led me to everything that I feel like is meaningful in what I do with my music, because it's not just a music issue. It's a real cultural issue. And what we're finding today is that people feel really divided, and they feel like, you know, I'm not like them and they're not like us. But when you look at the music of America, you find that this is a place where we all came together and created this beautiful thing. But if you rewrite history and take out one of the pillars of this, it's not like African Americans influenced people. They did, but they're also one of the main pillars of this. And that can't be stated strongly enough, that without African Americans, without Black string band music, without the banjo, country music as we know it would not exist.
And this goes back to the 1850s, where African Americans were leading in the banjo movement.
Well, it goes back way before that. I mean, the banjo comes from, you know, the 1700s. You've got the banjo coming up from the Caribbean, you know, up until the 1840s, 30s, you know, only Black people play the banjo. So it's only in the 1830s that white entertainers start to take it and perform with it, and it becomes a kind of inextricable part of the minstrel show. And that's one of the reasons why we don't engage with this, because you know, despite the fact that it was the most popular form of entertainment in America for over like 50 or 60 years, people want to forget it, you know, except for when it pops up with people wearing blackface, you know, even today. It's woven into our culture in so many different ways, and we just have to kind of come to grips with that in a way that is that is informed. You know, there's a lot of knee jerk reactions when somebody says minstrelsy, you know, but at the heart of minstrelsy is American music, is the music that kind of goes in. It's a combination of African, European, all of these kind of things go into what became minstrel music. So what happens in Ken's documentary, Ken Burns' country music documentary, is a piece of it, and it's a really important piece, but there's like a mountain under that we're trying to grapple with.
When you first got interested in square dancing, mm-hmm. did you know that it had been sort of created as a white genre by people like Henry Ford? And were you trying to rescue the roots of square dancing?
I mean, I had no idea. I mean, square dancing, you know, was I learned it in middle school. This is part of this whole thing to, you know, as this is America's dance or whatever. By America, we mean white America. And so I never thought it had anything to do with me, you know. Yeah. And so when I started calling contra dances as square, I kind of felt like, you know, we like to say I was the raisin in the oatmeal, you know. I was yeah. used to being the only one. And I kind of felt like I was sort of inserting myself in somebody else's tradition.
But you felt you were black then, because you say you're on both sides.
This is the reality of being, you know, biracial in America, you know, Southern, is that it's a shifting thing. It's a target that you can't ever really catch down, because some people treat me this way, some people treat me this way. When I'm here, I feel this way. When I'm here, I feel this way. And so I fluidly have followed that, you know. Now I feel like I'm North Carolinian, I'm yeah, Southern, right. you know. But back then, I mean, it's really hard. You know, you kind of have to try to. So even though it's a legacy that is mine just by right of being Southern, you know, I still kind of felt, and it also, I don't look like anybody else there, you know? So there's just realities to that. Yeah. But I got into it because I loved it, and I loved the banjo, and I loved the sound. And then as I started to find the history, I went, wow. You know, and then I found out that, oh, black people probably invented calling. Wow. That we played for these dances. Wow. Like, we had a huge piece of creating what has been set aside as this ethnically pure white thing. And I'm like, this is a problem, because the actual truth is actually way more interesting, and it's actually more indicative of who we are as a people. Like, people up here whose best interest it is to keep us divided, they don't want us to know this stuff, you know, because then it just makes us kind of, oh, then actually, oh, wait a minute, we outnumbered them. Wait a minute, you know? And this has been the conflict of the South since the very beginning, is keeping all the poor people, all the working class people at each other's throats through the invention of race. And that has been, you know, expressed through music. So I'm a musician, so it's the only way I can fight that is through knowing the history and doing it through music.
You have a 1850s replica banjo there. Well, show it to us and show us some of the roots of the music that you can do with that banjo.
So for me, this is a lot closer to, you know, I studied some pre-banjo instruments in West Africa, and to me, this is a lot closer to that than, you know, say the modern bluegrass banjo. So when I picked this up, I felt an affinity for it, and it's fretless. And for the majority of the banjo's life, this is what the banjo sounded like. It's deep and resonant, which is very different to what people think of as the banjo. So
show me some hillbilly roots that you would do on the banjo.
Well, it's interesting because there are things like, you know, the minstrel style of playing was called stroke style. It's called claw hammer today.
So it's percussive.
Oh yeah, the banjo is very percussive. You take off the stick, you have a drum, right?
Yeah.
And they think, you know, there's an idea that the way that they did this came from a frame drum or the tambourine, but I mean, that's unsubstantiated. But
so what other influences go in? We have the hillbilly. Tell us about some of the influences that go into banjo playing.
Well, I mean, hillbilly is a term that, you know, became used as a way to try to, you know, if you talk about hillbilly, it's like it's people who lived in the mountains, and they were from all over. You know, there was a lot of Scotch-Irish, there's a lot of this, but there's up to 20% were African-American, you know. And the idea of the music being, you know, untouched for hundreds of years in the mountains is kind of not a... It's not a thing, really. I mean, nobody is isolated. You know, people are more isolated than others. And there was music that definitely survived in the mountains longer than in other places. But it's kind of been taken as a thing, you know, and sort of this mythology has been, you know, has grown around it. So, you know, what goes into this early music is, you know, European dance forms, African, you know, tunes and rhythms, not just rhythm. You know, there's lots of, you know, tunes.
Show me a little African influence then.
I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to say. There's just things that I do feel when I play. There's a lot of techniques that are still in this old banjo minstrel tunes that have been kind of winnowed out when you start getting into later what we think of as Appalachian music on different kinds of banjos. And so I'm finding these kind of like, oh wow, that really feels like, you know, it's all feelings, you know,
because it feels like African. It feels like
you know, there's the, especially when I approach things in, you know, in that way, I'm like, oh, I can really hear this upstroke and this offbeat and all of this kind of stuff, you know. It really starts to come out of this really early minstrel music, and I just think that there's so many connections there that are still to be found, you know, still need to be studied. And I mean, I'm not a scholar, I'm a kind of armchair historian, but through just playing these things and, you know, coming from learning old time music from an older black string band musician, you know, I learned from Joe Thompson, who was 87, who's the last living link to that old, you know, Southern black string band tradition. And we now know that he is in direct line from a famous black string band musician named Frank Johnson from the 1800s, you know, and it's a direct lineage from Frank Johnson to me. And so having that kind of vibe and then approaching these minstrel tunes, I feel like has brought, you know, a different way of looking at them than, say, just sort of maybe an academic way.
And you create the Carolina Chocolate Drops as a banjo band, in a way, to help resurrect and play with this music?
Yeah, I'm a co-founder of that band along with Don Flemons and Justin Robinson. It all came out of us going and playing with Joe Thompson, playing with him on Thursday nights and sort of absorbing his family's music. And, you know, I played the banjo because Joe would never play without a banjo player. So I said, well, I'll play banjo. And Justin played fiddle and Don played guitar. And we just kind of absorbed as much as we could from, you know, it's a different kind of conservatory.
Show me something you did with the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
I wouldn't have played this banjo back then. Georgia Buck is dead. Last word he said, don't you put no shonen in my bread.
Some of the things you resurrect have been really painful, or that you're working on, especially the Wilmington Massacre, which is sort of also been forgotten in history a little bit. Tell me what you're doing.
A lot bit. I mean, I'm from North Carolina, and we did not learn this in school. It's astonishing that we did not learn this. It should be taught nationally. It was the only coup on American soil, you know? I mean, this is huge.
Tell me about it.
So what happened was, you know, in Wilmington, you had, in 1898, you had a fairly progressive idea of, you had black middle class wealth, you had blacks and whites working together, and most importantly, you had a political party called the Fusionists, where you had whites and blacks working together, and that's what people didn't like. So the ruling sort of, I guess they had been ruling, you know, the white supremacists basically, you know, did not like this. And so they did a campaign. They used the KKK, you know, campaign of intimidation, the kind of the usual usual thing the year leading up into the elections. People got a bunch of guns and they just shot it. They shot people. They ran prominent black and white citizens out of town, you know, never to be allowed to return. They shot a lot of black people just in the streets who or some ran off into the swamps, petrified and died of exposure. I mean, it was an awful chapter in our history. And then it was completely covered up like it never happened. You know?
So what are you going to do with it musically?
I mean, I'd like to make a piece of art out of the... It's not even just so much... The massacre is a horrible thing, the act of violence. But what I want to focus on is, you know, the idea of what we had. You know, it was possible. You know, the idea that we could live in harmony at that time, that if that had been not stopped in its tracks, you know, what could it have led to, you know, and the fact that the federal government didn't do a darn thing. I mean, so I think the idea of highlighting the beauty and feeling the heartbreak that was destroyed, you know, rather than focusing on the act of destruction.
So what will it be?
I'm not sure yet. I mean, I think a stage production would be amazing. You know, I'm still kind of figuring it out because John Jeremiah Sullivan has been working on this research for years, and I know he's working on a
And he wrote the New Yorker piece.
He wrote the New Yorker piece on me. And that's how I learned about the massacre, because he lives in Wilmington. And so I know, you know, we'll be working on whatever it is together, because his research has just been unbelievable. He's finding out a lot of really important things about it. So I think it's going to be an important thing to discuss, especially now we've got the 1619 project. It's a lot of people have been really grappling with where we are, where we've come from, and I think these things from the past that aren't that long ago, when you look at it, can really be, you know, when you grapple with them in an artistic way and get people emotionally invested, you can really make a difference talking about what's happening now, you know, because then you can see more clearly, you know, the traces.
Thank you so much for
joining us.
And as she points out, all contemporary American music traces its roots to African American music. That's it for now. Remember, you can listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.